and that upon tasting it, we shall let go of our ideas of the world and maintain Buddha Dharma for the sake of all beings. As I just left the building over there, the Shoho is tuning in to the live webcast of the mountain seat ceremony. Kiku Christina Lenher is, as we speak, ascending the mountain of San Francisco Zen Center, becoming the next abbess. As I walked down the stairs, the first drum beats were sounding as the procession entered the Buddha Hall. So it's during this talk, that's what's happening up north a bit. So you can dedicate the merit of our gathering now to her term as abbess for the next some years. May it be of great benefit to San Francisco Zen Center. Before we tune back into Dogen's stern admonitions, let's keep remembering to celebrate the wonders of nature. Again, the Gendur Koan says here, in mustering the whole body and mind and seeing forms, in mustering the whole body and mind, hearing sounds, they are intimately perceived. That's one translation. And Yasutani Roshi, very energetic Zen teacher, commenting on this section of the Genjo Koan, says, body and mind are fundamentally one. We were speaking about this earlier. Regarding them as two is a thought, a delusion. When you're happy, is it your mind that's happy or your body that's happy? When you're hungry, is it your body or your mind? Don't be asinine. It's both. Both are one. When mind and body are working separately, neither of them is any good, and they're utterly incomplete. The whole idea is extremely frivolous. Be serious. Mind and body are always one. Yeah. Here Dogen Zenji shows the manner of earnestly practicing the Buddha way. It's completely mustering the whole body and mind. Seeing and hearing, standing and sitting, it's completely mustering the whole body and mind. That's just, wholeheartedly, or shikan ta. It's just walking, just working, just sitting. It's just being in samadhi throughout the 24 hours of the day. This is the way of practice of our predecessors, the Buddhas and ancestors. In modern terms, one can call this living fully. And then he brings up Xiang Yan's sweeping the garden and the pebble and the bamboo, and he brings up Ling Yun seeing the peach blossoms. and he brings up Sudompo hearing the sound of the valley stream as the long, broad tongue of the Buddha. So in the classic Genjo Koan, we have seeing forms or colors and hearing sounds, fully engaging body and mind. And Dobin's classic wholehearted practice of the way, in the Jijiu Zamai section, we chanted also earlier today. Did you notice the teaching of the non-sentient in there? It's there too, right? It's everywhere. Because you are in the state of self-fulfilling samadhi, without disturbing its quality or moving a particle, you extend the Buddha's great activity, the incomparably profound and subtle teaching, in a moment of zazen without doing anything. Grass, trees, and lands, which are embraced by this teaching, together radiate a great light and endlessly expound the inconceivable, profound Dharma. Grass, trees, and lands during our self-fulfilling samadhi radiate this great light and expound the Dharma. Grass, trees, and walls bring forth the teaching for ordinary people as well as sages. Remember, Dongshan's teacher said, who hears the teaching of the insentient walls, tiles, and pebbles? The sages hear it. Ordinary people don't hear it. So Dogen's taking this a step further. These grass, trees, and walls bring forth the teaching for all beings, just common, ordinary people, as well as sages. And then those ordinary people and sages in accord bring forth the teaching for grass, trees, and walls. So in Jijiu Zamai, in the samadhi, in the concentration of the self receiving its function, the self receiving and employing samadhi, body and mind are mustered, ketchup, and fully experience color and sound, and the teaching of grass, trees, and walls, non-sentient beings, teaching Dharma round and around, Dharma received by all beings expounding the Dharma to the grass, trees, and walls, and the grass, trees, and walls expounding the Dharma to the people, and pebbles flying all over the place, knocking down all the bamboo in sight, peach blossoms raining all over the earth. But to fully settle in to this self-fulfilling samadhi where all this is imperceptibly occurring, we have to let go of any seeking of reputation and gain, fame and profit, and become like, kind of like trees and walls and pebbles that actually don't seek to be the best tree best rock don't seem to be, don't want to be promoted in their rock village. The trees don't seem to want to have a little more nourishment to their roots than other trees. So we're at the section on page 3 in this Valley Sound Mountain Color celebration, where thus foolish people do not understand the wise, small-minded ones regard great sages as enemies. Also, the ancestors in India were sometimes overpowered by kings, those outside the way or practitioners of the two lesser vehicles. It was not that the ancestors lacked deep understanding or that those others excelled. The Indian ancestors were sometimes overpowered by kings, those, you know, outside the Buddha way, or practitioners of the Shravaka and Pratyeka Buddha vehicle. So we have at least one of our Zen ancestors, Arya Simha, the 24th Indian ancestor. Shishibo Dai Dai Yosho was a great practitioner of the Buddha way, and other practitioners of other ways were messing around and wanted to steal something maybe from the king. So they said, let's in case we get caught, let's put on Buddhist robes to do the job, and that way they'll blame the Buddhists and their local leader, Shishi Bodai, noble lion, Arya Simha. And that's what they did, and they got caught, and they blamed him. And the king, who was a follower and had taken refuge with Arya Simha, was easily convinced by these deviant troublemakers that he was the culprit, the problem. And so to test him, he's like, well, you know, we're going to have to kill him then, right? And said, you know, totally turned on his teacher, right? And said, so you're really free of any attachment to body and mind? And he said, yeah, I am. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, then, just to make sure, I'm going to cut off your head now, okay? And he said, okay, if that's what's going to happen now. I think there had been a prophecy beforehand, too, that there was going to be trouble for him. So he's like, well, this is the time when the troubles come. I guess cause and effect has to play out like this. So the king personally swung the axe. His head came off, and white milk shot out of his neck 10 feet into the sky. And at that time, the king was like, uh-oh. This was not an ordinary being. And the hand that was holding the axe suddenly like twisted around like 10 times and fell off. and the king himself died a few days later. So luckily, Shishibo Dai Daiyosho.
Hopefully he transmitted.
Bashashita Daiyosho had the Dharma. Yes, he did. And that's why he was also ready to go. It's recorded in the story. He said, I've passed on the two Dharma Eye Treasury. This will continue, and will eventually reach America. So you can take my head now. In fact, maybe in America, in a few thousand years, they'll even tell the story of my head getting chopped off. Because that's how strong this lineage is, right? That they'll know about this ancient Indian link that far in the future. So, sometimes this happens. The ancestors in India were sometimes overpowered by kings and others. When Bodhidharma came from India and stayed at Mount Sung, neither the emperor of Liang nor the emperor of Wei understood him. At that time, we know about that story, right? When the emperor came to Bodhidharma, asked who he was, and Bodhidharma said, "I don't know." The emperor didn't understand. At that time, there were two critics, the Tripitaka master, the scripture master Bodhiruchi, and the Vinaya, the precept master Guangtong. They were afraid they would lose their fame, their empty fame, and gain to a true person, a true teacher, so they tried to block him. It was as if they were trying to cover the sun. They were worse than Devadatta, who lived at the time of the Buddha. So these two, as the story goes, those who were famous scripture teachers and living near Bodhidharma's cave, people started getting interested in Bodhidharma's silent sitting facing the wall. It caught their attention, and they said, "Well, seems like there's something really direct and straightforward about Bodhidharma's practice there. So maybe their popularity started to wane, and they got jealous and tried to poison Bodhidharma." Five times they tried, but Bodhidharma, due to his, like, according to legend, his special knowledge of Chinese medicine. Bodhidharma was kind of like, you know, he was the founder of all these Chinese martial arts too, right? And sounds like Chinese medicine, Qigong, and he had all these kind of like Qi powers going that could cure him from poison five times. But on the sixth attempt, he said to himself, "Again, the Dharma's been transmitted to Hueka. It seems like the conditions are not so good here for me to keep doing my thing. So, okay, I'm ready." And he let himself be poisoned. A great first ancestor in China, Bodhidharma. So we have two of our ancestors murdered by jealous other practitioners seeking fame and profit. Isn't Dogen's bringing this up? Pretty dramatic, whether these things happened or not. And you know about Devadatta? These guys were worse than Devadatta, but Devadatta is the one of the Buddha's cousin, and who tried to kill the Buddha several times in various ways, again out of seeking fame and profit. He loved the Buddha. He joined the Buddha's order. At first he just wanted to follow the Buddha's way, and then as he started getting more popular and he wanted to kind of like start his own order apart from the Buddha, and the Buddha suggested that wouldn't be such a good idea. But he did try, in fact. But then not only that, I mean, that's like splitting the Sangha. That's already like a major faux pas. but then to actually try to literally kill the Buddha, here in the Lotus Sutra, there's a chapter on Devadatta, right? Where even Devadatta, like the worst of the worst, receives his prediction of Buddhahood. That's the infinitely compassionate spirit of the Mahayana and the Lotus Sutra. What a pity. The fame and gain they were attached to would have been discarded like excrement by Bodhidharma. This behavior was the result of their lack of understanding Buddha Dharma. They were like dogs barking at a well-intentioned person. Do not resent such dogs, but vow to guide them with this blessing. Please arouse the thought of enlightenment, dogs. An old sage said, there are animals who have human faces. In other words, they look like people, but they're really dogs. We don't want to disparage dogs, but they're like the kind of dogs that bark at people who are just didn't cause them any trouble just because the dogs are like the bark, aggressive dogs. On the other hand, there are demons or Mara who take refuge in the Buddha and make offerings to him. This can happen too. An earlier Buddha said, do not get close or intimate to kings, princes, ministers, administrators, Brahmins, and lay people. So, practitioners should remember this admonition so that as their practice advances, the merit of their bodhisattva effort with beginner's mind will accumulate. So that might be like, wait a second, we need more explanation here. What's that all about? Don't be intimate with living beings? Isn't that our practice to be intimate and close to everyone? So, you know that? You know where this comes from? The Lotus Sutra. The repose and bliss chapter. The practice of repose and bliss, of ease and joy. In this translation, chapter 14, a happy life. So it sounds a little, well, this will hopefully clarify. There's some, you know, maybe some problems in this chapter. This might be one of the problematic chapters for some people in the Lotus Sutra. But here it's, the Buddha says to Manjushri, a bodhisattva, first he says, if any bodhisattva, mahasattva, desires to teach the Lotus Sutra in the age of decline to come, he or she should be steadfast in the four methods. First, steadfast in the bodhisattva's spheres of action and intimacy, so that he may be able to teach this sutra to living beings. The bodhisattva's spheres of action and intimacy are necessary to teach the Lotus Sutra in the future. If a bodhisattva, mahasattva, abides in a state of patience, is gentle and agreeable, is neither hasty nor overbearing, and his mind is imperturbed. This is what the sphere of action of a bodhisattva is. Nice practice instructions. Abiding in a state of patience, being gentle and agreeable, neither hasty nor overbearing, and imperturbed. If, moreover, he has no extremes that he grasps, could say, but sees all things in their reality, nor proceeds along the undivided way. This is termed a bodhisattva mahasattva sphere of action. Why is the other termed a bodhisattva mahasattva's sphere of intimacy? And here's the line. A bodhisattva mahasattva is not intimate in the sphere of intimacy. The Bodhisattva is not intimate with kings, princes, ministers, and rulers, not intimate with heretics, Brahmins, Nigrantas, and so on, these, you know, different non-Buddhist sects, sounding really like kind of limited and sectarian, nor with composers of worldly literature and poetry, with the these different schools that existed at that time. Nor does he resort to brutal sports and boxing and wrestling, nor to various juggling performances of Nartakas and others. Nor does he consort with chandalas, keepers of pigs, sheep, fowl, and dogs, hunters, fishermen, and those engaged in these types of pursuits. So it actually doesn't ever say in here lay people. So, but I think maybe that's referring to people with these particularly like kind of harmful occupations, like butchers and hunters and fishermen, harming living beings. Whenever such people as these sometimes come to him, this is the funny part now, right? He's not intimate with these people, but when they come to him, he teaches the Dharma to them, expecting nothing in return. So it's not like he just avoids them. So maybe we can deduce that this intimate means like hanging out with them, you know, on their hunting trips, that kind of intimacy. intimate in the Dharma, intimate in teaching the Dharma when they come to them, and expecting nothing in return, not seeking fame or profit for teaching the Dharma, maybe not even expecting them to give up hunting in return, just presenting Dharma. But then it does say also doesn't become intimate in the same way with, it does say, you know, lay people, but also monks and nuns. So it's not singling out anybody. It's just everybody, all the Buddhists, right? And those ones particularly seeking the fruits of Shravaka, the two vehicles. And yet, if they come to him, he takes the opportunity of teaching the Dharma, expecting nothing in return. So, so we could add, if we could edit Dogen, we might say, an earlier Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, said, don't get close to kings, princes, etc. You know, in order to seek with expectation some fame and profit, just offer them Dharma when they ask. There are stories of Indra who came down to test the aspiration of a practitioner or of the demon Papiyan, it's another name for Mara, who obstructed people's practice. Such things happen when practitioners cannot free themselves from desire for fame and gain. But such things do not happen to those who have great compassion and whose vow to guide sentient beings is vast and mature. Great compassion, dai ji dai hi, great loving kindness and great compassion. Through the power of practice, you may be given the gift of an entire nation, and this may appear to be a great achievement in the world, but do not be blinded. Look deeply on such an occasion. Foolish people may rejoice, but they are like dogs licking a dry bone. Wise people and sages reject this, just as worldly people are disgusted by excrement. Licking a dry bone is like, you know, Maybe they may be given palaces and huge monasteries, right? And and thinking, what a great meal we're having here, but actually there's no nourishment in it. It has a little flavor on the outside of that dry bone, but there's nothing really there. Yes.
It seems so strange to me that here's this like this teaching that has these real transcendent kind of, you know, sections.
Mm-hmm.
And then he really spends a lot of time just laying out this don't, you know,
yeah,
his admonitions, and he gets into these, you know, kind of sort of details about
it goes on for a while about it.
It makes me curious. Of course, we can never know because, you know, mm-hmm, we can't, but makes me wonder, what was this about?
Yeah.
What was
yeah. There's definitely like a change of flavor from all these stories about awakening to colors and sounds and the beautiful direct display of nature, then shifts into this. But it seems that the transitional shift, right, was... Mm-hmm.
On those pitiful fellows.
Well, he's like, these ones that realized it on the bottom of page two, he's praising those who heard the valley sounds and saw the mountain colors, and then said, authentic study, free of concern for fame and gain, should be based on such aspiration.
Yeah,
these people had aspiration.
The whole fourth of the entire
It's a funny combination. So it could be that it was actually a talk, right? And he was bringing up this, and then it was a tangent, like we often get into, right? That maybe someone even asked. Maybe one of his students that he felt like was particularly, or maybe somebody asked, let's do it, let's see the mountain colors directly. We'll be like, let's all see it, and we will be the greatest Zen temple in all of Japan. And then it was like, wait a second. Something like that. We don't know, but there was a shift here. And, you know, and at the very end, it's going to come back to, you know, briefly, the mountains and waters again. But there's something I think really sweet and poignant about this combination. It's kind of like getting us really excited and inspired, and then saying, okay, now that you're got you going here, now let's really like get grounded and really look at our stuff that's actually preventing this. Or maybe because it sounds so it's one of the more straightforward sounding dharmas, right? Seeing colors and hearing sounds and these realizations that happened to all three people that he mentions were like effortless. He did mention their long practice of the way before then, but at that time it was like just resting at ease in the mountains, and the way was brought to them like spontaneously. So then maybe to balance out that part too, it's like here's the like nitty-gritty work that must be done to easefully receive sounds and colors. He doesn't really say that, though, right? But that's one way to look at it. In general, when you're a beginner, you cannot fathom the Buddha way. Your assumptions do not hit the mark. The fact that you cannot fathom the Buddha way as beginner, in both these cases, beginner is actually says beginner's mind. So this is like another turn. Sometimes beginner's mind is like the mind is totally open to direct dharma. But here it's like beginner's mind cannot fathom the Buddha way. The fact that you cannot fathom the Buddha way with beginner's mind does not mean that you lack ultimate understanding, but that you do not recognize the deepest point. Endeavor wholeheartedly to follow the path of earlier sages. You may have to climb mountains and cross oceans when you look for a teacher to inquire about the way. Look for a teacher, Kalyana Mitra is the term in Sanskrit here, that means good friend. Mitra is, you know, like Maitri, loving kindness. Good, loving, kind friend is the name for the spiritual guide or the teacher in the Buddha's time. And there's one sutra in the early teachings. Ananda, I think it's Ananda, comes to the Buddha and says something like, aren't good friends in the holy life like, you know, a necessary and one most important part of the way? Something like that. And the Buddha says in the sutra, don't say that, Ananda. Good friends are like the whole of the way of practice. Very strongly says. And then the Buddha says, and I, Ananda, am the good friend. So we can hear that in many ways, like teachers are necessary and just good friends, Dharma companions on the path, which is ideally what teachers are too, are the whole of the holy life. Look for a teacher and search for understanding with all-encompassing effort. Here it says, as if you were coming down from heaven or emerging from the ground. But all the other translations, that to me that seems like, I don't know what that would be about. All the other translations say, look for this teacher, looking for the teacher and searching for understanding with all-encompassing effort. The teacher comes down from heaven or emerges from the ground. And we have a chapter in the Lotus Sutra called Bodhisattvas Emerging from the Ground. So, which we could take as just aspire to meet the Dharma and a good friend, and then spontaneously, or without, you know, in unexpected ways, they come down from the heavens and bodhisattvas sprout up from the ground to help us in our with our aspiration to meet them. Again, the inquiry and response come up together. When you encounter the teacher, you invoke sentient beings as well as insentient beings. So that's made its way back in here. You hear with the body, you hear with the mind. To hear with the ear is an everyday matter, literally, is to hear with the ear is ordinary tea and rice, which is maybe a Zen phrase for ordinary things. But to hear with the eye is not always so. And that's, you know, going back to referring to Dongshan's verse brought up earlier about when Dongshan has this long conversation about the teaching of the non-sentient with two different teachers. And then finally, reflecting on all of those conversations, Dongshan composed the following verse. You maybe remember. How amazing, how amazing. Hard to comprehend that non-sentient beings expound the Dharma. It simply cannot be heard with the ear, but when sound is heard with the eye, then it's understood. So here Dogen says, hear with the ear is ordinary tea and rice, but to hear with the eye is not always so. And not referring to the visual sense organ, but the Dharma eye, which from the very first sutra that the Buddha taught, it's recorded in the sutra by, like, the narrator. So maybe Ananda actually came up with the phrase when the Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths, and Anyata Kondinya. Oh, I see. It's now clear, this whole issue of the struggle of this path is clear as day. I'm not finished yet, but I deeply see the principle of the Four Noble Truths. Grasping body and mind as me basically is suffering. And the cessation of suffering is letting go of that. And then the narrator says, and at that moment there arose in Venerable Anyata Kondinya the pure Dharma eye. So that insight into truth is the Dharma eye. And Dogen has his own version, his own treasury of the true Dharma eye in many, many, many words. And these are some of them. But the hearing with the body, hearing with the mind, mustering body and mind, we hear, see things directly. But not just hearing with the ear, that's an everyday matter, but hearing with the eye is not always so. When you see Buddha, you see self-Buddha, other Buddha, large Buddha, small Buddha. Do not be frightened by a large Buddha. Do not be put off by a small Buddha. Just see large and small Buddhas as valley sounds and mountain colors, as a broad, long tongue, and as 84,000 verses. This is liberation. This is complete seeing. So now, he remembered. He was talking about valley sounds and mountain colors. Large and small Buddhas, there's no particular fixed form of Buddhas. And they come through hearing with the eye. And they come as valley sounds and mountain colors, the long, broad tongue and 84,000 verses. Before we leave the section on abandoning fame and profit, a little bit more from the record of things heard. Zui Mong Ki. Dogen says, I first aroused bodhicitta because of my realization of impermanence. I visited many places near and far to find a true teacher, and eventually left where I was practicing on Mount Hiei and settled at Kaninji. But I still hadn't met a good teacher or co-practitioners, and I became confused, and evil thoughts arose. First of all, my teachers, I guess there, or Mount Hiei or Kaninji, they taught me that I should study as hard as our predecessors did in order to become wise and to be known at the court and famous all over the country. That's what they told him. So he's like, at first I had this just true bodhicitta, and then later told me, like, keep practicing hard and you'll be a really great, famous practitioner. So he kind of forgot his original beginner's mind. So when I studied the teachings, I thought of becoming equal to the ancient wise people of this and other countries. And then when I started reading these records of the about the lifestyles of eminent monks and practitioners of Buddha Dharma in China, they were different from what my teachers taught. I also began to understand that such a mind as I had aroused was despised and hated in all the sutras and commentaries. In other words, the mind seeking fame and reputation. Then I finally realized that even if I think of gaining fame, it would be better to feel small before the ancient wise people and sincere people of later generations than to be well thought of by inferior people of today. So I thought it would be better to be like kind of lower than those great ancient ones than to be thought of as higher by worldly people who, you know, think I'm great for some reason that they think. That's not really true. If I wish to be equal to someone, then it would be better to feel small standing before these eminent predecessors of India and China and work toward being their equal. So I wish to become equal to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. I completely reformed my former frame of mind. Look at the life of Buddha. He abandoned the throne and entered the mountains and forests, begging for his food his whole life, even after he had completed the way. So, an ancient said, do not be arrogant and consider yourself equal to superior wise people. So, like, this is, so not better even, but equal, right? Like, we're just like the Buddhas and ancestors of the past. We sometimes might think that, say that, but that would be kind of arrogant. Maybe. I mean, Buddhas and ancestors of old were as we are now. Yet, in Dogen's humbleness here, he's like, he's constantly the yearning for the ancient way, right? There's the past ancestors are always like the great ones. We might think, well, wait a second, then isn't everything just steadily declining? That might be one view, but I see it more as just the spirit of just being humble. And don't think like, we might do this sometimes, right? In America, we've, you know, all these stuff that people were hung up on and in those Asian practices, we've gone beyond them. We've like come up with the true Buddha Dharma now. The American Dharma's free and fresh and far surpasses those ancestors. Maybe so in some ways, but I think if we start thinking that way, it won't be good for us. So do not be arrogant and consider yourself equal to superior wise people, but also do not deprecate yourself and think of yourself inferior. This means that, that's a quote of an ancient. Dogen says, this means that both are a kind of arrogance. So to think of yourself as higher or lower is arrogant, actually, right? And then he also says, don't think of yourself as equal. And in fact, that is the case. And in the early teachings, one of the the 10 fetters that's dropped away at arhatship, to realize an arhat. One of the last ones, actually, after going through these other stages on that way, for the fruit of arhatship, it's sometimes translated as arrogance, but it's defined as thinking of oneself as better than others, or less than others, or equal to others. That's like a, so obviously, like, major arrogance, like, I'm just better than others, that's dropped away, like, much earlier in the path. But this final, I mean, this is the culmination of the entire Buddhist path in the early canon, right? So for that culmination, this is this final thread of subtle, maybe arrogance isn't quite the right word, and we just say comparative mind, even, but a very subtle kind of comparative mind that doesn't think of oneself as better or worse or even equal. Because even saying we're equal is comparative. It's like there's no comparison anymore. So again, if we're getting the issues of high self-esteem and low self-esteem, yeah, it's not a matter of, well, let's lower ourselves and feel really ashamed and worse than everybody. No, because that's just another form of arrogance, actually. But also don't go to the other extreme of we're better and even to compare at all. Because every being abides in their totally unique Dharma position, which fully includes everything. There's no other way than it can be at each moment, and that's like completely perfect. And furthermore, we all share Buddha nature equally without the slightest exception, which is part of the beauty of the Buddha nature teachings, even with termites. The Buddha nature is, people might be further or lesser along in some imaginary path, but Buddha nature, the nature of mind as clear, open awareness, non-dual awareness, is equal for everyone. The obscurations that block it might not be equal. That might be like the perfect Dharma position that we each uniquely are, according to causes and conditions. Part of the Dharma position is the unique blend of obscurations to Buddha nature. So the obscurations are perfect in that way because they're perfectly dependently arisen. They have nothing to do with us, actually, right? And the Buddha nature is perfect beyond conditions. Any questions or things to bring up about gain? Yes.
Are there any practices that you know of that could help us kind of give up that idea of reputation? Not idea, but what I mean is, it seems like I think, you know, maybe the first time I stepped into a temple, I thought maybe that was a good decision. And that all decisions made inside that temple or inside this practice container couldn't possibly be bad. Uh-huh. Couldn't possibly go wrong. Couldn't possibly be seeking fame or gain. But, after, it's come up before, but it's really coming up during this, you know, it's like, why are we doing these things, and how do we, like, let ourselves be vulnerable without, you know, encouraging others to slander us, but at the same time, you know, being true and not trying to, you know, fame and gain.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, being vulnerable, did you say?
Yeah, because there's like this real practical thing, you know, that like people get asked to leave, and people sometimes don't get asked to be on staff. And I'm speaking from personal experience. Mm. Hasn't happened yet, so mm. not personal experience, but it's a fear.
You've heard about it.
Yeah, it seems like it happens. Mm.
And what? How does that relate? How does now?
Well, because that makes me want to be like very responsible, like say yes to everything.
So that you'll get promoted.
Well, not promoted, just so I don't have to leave.
Well, I think to be asked to leave a temple, you have to get pretty bad.
Don't be afraid to have that capacity.
Yeah, I mean, you could say like sometimes they say you just go along with, you know, temples often have like there's certain guidelines and precepts, and you know, they're not that extreme, they're not that strict around California Dharma, as far as they could, you know, as much as they could be. It's all relative, I suppose. For some people, they're extremely impossible, but they're designed to be reasonable. So you could say just to go along with that is you probably won't be asked to leave. Usually the people asked to leave are like, there's a very clear kind of guideline and people are just like way out of accord with it. So, and then you could say, you don't even need to do much extra. Sometimes we might even say, I mean, one way to practice is just to like go along with the guidelines and the schedule just as they are. Don't do anything less, or sometimes we might have to make exceptions and then we check it out and we get permission. But also, you don't need to do anything extra. That'd be one way of practice that might be very difficult, because we either want to do a little bit more or a little bit less than this kind of like middle way that's often presented. And it's kind of like a group consensus middle way, usually. So, you know, I heard a story about there was somebody from the Zen Center a long, long time ago went to Japan and was used to, you know, at Zen Center there's times when you can like practice extra like night sitting, right? So it's outside the schedule. It's not required, but it was like people do it, and that's a great practice to check out the fame and gain mind. Am I sitting extra to be for my reputation? Am I sitting extra because I just want to wholeheartedly sit? Somebody went to Japan in some temple and he like sat extra, and the story was like they like drugged him, so he went unconscious and he woke up like on a train going out of the town with all his stuff packed up for doing extra. Not for breaking the guidelines, right, but for doing, you know, more than was asked. So that's one, you know, and I don't know about that, you know. People often ask that at places like Tassajara. People who have a lot of energy feel like, well, we could be doing a lot more here. Should we? Or should we just follow along? Is that kind of adding extra? So this is a big koan for every practitioner, I think. And I wouldn't, you know, drug people and put them on trains if they sat extra zazen.
What do you have to do here to get that treatment?
Excommunicated. Here we have very few guidelines, so it's got to be really extreme. So you can try. Actually, in Sesshin, though, we do have guidelines in Sesshin, and I don't think we've, since I've been around, people have been asked to leave Sesshin for, due to guidelines, but they might get asked to come into line with them. So, but apart from Sesshin, yeah, it's all about harming others. So even if guidelines are broken and people repent and feel, and say, actually, I really didn't want to hurt anyone, I'm sorry. Often then they're, unless it's extreme, they're still forgiven. It takes a lot to be asked to leave. Now for Dogen, it maybe didn't take that much. I don't know. Yeah.
I think this question you brought up is a really, I think I would call it like a tender question, this issue of vulnerability.
Yes.
And to me, it's really the heart of Sangha practice. And I feel like really like making the commitment, you know, we kind of show up and do a little showing up, and then at some point, kind of step into the Sangha. At least that was how I felt my experience was. There was some point at which I kind of stepped in, and then it's like, you know, this vulnerability to all that happens among us humans with judgments and opinions and about how one presents oneself. Mm-hmm. And then you just stay. I mean, I was thinking of Kathy's comment about, you know, people who, no matter how difficult and confusing and painful it gets, your commitment is really also, you know, to practicing together.
Mm-hmm.
And so you just keep coming forward.
Not turning away.
And if it looks like you're trying to be special and people have that judgment, you just work. I think
the Sangha can hold that, all of that. Yeah, yeah. And in fact, the great thing about Sangha practice is so many of our tendencies get revealed that we kind of can't really do. If we're just practicing alone, it's much safer and more comfortable because our tendencies are just, we can just keep doing them. But when we're practiced together, yeah, for sure, they also talk about the rock tumbler effect, right? That we're all like rough rocks, but when you put the Sangha together and bounce it all, it smooths out the rough edges of the rocks, all our rough tendencies. We smooth each other, you know, almost like unintentionally, just by practicing together. Yes.
Yeah, but you know, it can be a painful thing if your MO is to want to look good and have a good reputation. Because what I've learned, I mean, I tend towards that. You know, I like people to like me and I try to do the right thing. And, you know, you can do what you think, you can do your best and you can still be, people can still think you're a jerk, you know, or you're wrong or you're bad. And so there's a way sometimes I think that there's a certain kind of humility that is painful, but that is also like a deep practice of where you go, there's nothing I can do about what this person thinks about me, you know? And then you might try to do the right thing, try to prepare it, you try to, but they're in this different place. They're just in a different place. And you just, you know, you go, oh, it's really hard, but at some point, you just have to let go of trying to do it right, because it can't always be right for somebody, you know? And that's been a really hard lesson for me to learn in my life. I don't like that lesson at all. But, you know, when we talk about Sangha practice and vulnerability and, you know, confessing our desires for reputation, and, you know, at some point it's sort of unavoidable that you just walk the... You know, you walk the line and
yeah.
You're just humbled.
Yeah.
And you know.
Mm-hmm.
What can you do?
Staying true to ourselves seems essential, the basic practice. Yeah.
And you know, I've heard it said that, you know, if you really want to, if you think you don't have an ego, then just have the experience of somebody falsely accusing you.
Yes.
And all of a sudden you have, you taste your ego.
Yes,
you know?
Yeah.
And that's just one of the hardest things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's one thing if you really did something wrong and you feel bad about it, mm-hmm. somebody calls you on it. But if you really don't think you did anything wrong, mm-hmm. somebody's still accusing you, it's like the hardest thing.
Yep. You know, the eight worldly winds are... These eight winds that blow us off our seat, you could say, are fame and disgrace, those two poles. Praise and blame are like almost the same thing, but like a little less. Like that's a momentary thing. Fame and disgrace are like a whole reputation. But praise and blame in one moment, just like you say, false blame especially, really throws us. Gain and loss is kind of like profit, gain, and then like pain and pleasure. These are this is a great little list to remember and check out in your zazen. Am I being moved in big or small ways by leaning towards or away from gain and loss? Those are the two opposites. Pain and pleasure maybe is the root one, actually. Praise and blame, fame and disgrace. Yes.
Oh, I was going to say that during my practice period, there was someone that was really struggling with kind of the group as a whole, really thinking that they were kind of doing the practice and other people weren't,
mm-hmm.
in a very public way.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting because I think most people could kind of see that she was a little, you know, she was skewed in her understanding. But there was a great deal of compassion that was kind of showed to her by teachers and things like that. And she had great dedication. It's just that there was this kind of thing that she wasn't able to see.
Maybe wanting to get more credit for her dedication than she was getting.
Oh, yes, very much so. But anyway, around that time I read something probably in Reb's book, maybe it was, I forget which one, but about the enthusiasm of the new practitioner and versus, and where a lot of times there's that urge to sort of prove yourself, and, you know, you're the best practitioner ever, and versus the kind of practice of the person that's been around for a while who is kind of relaxed that phase, and how those two ends of the spectrum of practice do kind of balance each other out.
Mm-hmm.
That there's a certain enthusiasm that that zealot of a new practitioner, you know, kind of raises that enthusiasm for others.
Yeah, there's a good thing about it. Yeah.
They eventually kind of get,
mm-hmm.
just from being around for a while and seeing other, you know, mature practitioners that don't do extra. I mean, they do what they do fully, but they don't, you know, they aren't looking for something extra than it. So I thought that was very interesting.
That's a great observation, that they actually, they're both very useful, even though both may be slightly off in opposite directions. They help. That's an example, Sangha practice helping each other. These ones saying, well, maybe we are a little bit lazy here. And these ones saying, well, maybe we are a little arrogant. And together they like turn the Dharma wheel. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
I'm really glad that you brought up the issue of greater or lesser, and my real recent experience of comparative mind when being asked to be Shiso.
Yeah.
You know, I kept looking at Nanette and thinking, well, she has these skill sets that seem so apropos to the position. And so I judge myself and lessen myself, and in going to four different teachers for advice, the good Dr. Tiberbaugh came up with your mind isn't going to change in this lifetime. So give up. You know, and I was looking for some kind of solid answer, some real remedy to the problem. And it was give up, you know? And so there's a lot of wisdom in that.
Have you given up?
Pretty much.
And you are the Shuso. Nothing lacking. Nothing extra. Here you are. We don't have a problem with you.
But it's funny.
So far.
Just wait. I'm really, really glad that you brought that whole thing of comparing. Is not always apparent in terms of, you know, thinking greater than is obvious, but thinking lesser than or equal to is not obvious. And by bringing that up and considering that, it really brings light to, you know, what my personal dilemma was for quite a little while in kind of blaming myself to, oh, this isn't okay. What was he thinking? You know? And so, yeah, giving up is kind of appropriate.
And even for people who we might feel like they're kind of arrogant, we don't need to make a problem of that either, right? That's just that's what their conditions right now are such. So that's their dharma position. Fine. And I, instead of feeling like kind of offended by it or something, we should get them back down here with me. It's like, no, it's okay. Yeah. They can do their thing.
It's just their nature.
Yeah. And it's changing. Yeah. It's, you know, for now, that's how it is.
I know, for me, I had a little awakening to that was, I was on the regular labor crew that did dishes every day. And it's amazing what you can kind of, how you can place yourself above even in the most
so, cleaner dishes, faster dishes.
Expert, machine, you know? And there was like a whole thing about showing other people how to do it and stuff like that. And then the actual work leader kind of went, you know, Jane, you don't really need to do that. You know, people, they're going to figure it out. And that's kind of not really your role to kind of do that. I was like, you know, it was just burning with what? Here I'm such a good dishwasher. But it was great. Actually, it was great to kind of just do what you've been asked to do. And you don't have to kind of take on someone else's, you know, if they're not doing it correctly, they're going to figure it out.
Yeah.
It was very useful for me.
I also think this basic practice of just being true to oneself and, you know, not being concerned for up or down or even whether we get kicked out or not, thinking of Austin's concern, well, what if, don't I have to make sure that I don't get kicked out? I think of this great story of one of our Chinese Zen ancestors who, maybe you know this one, about he was the Tenzo. The cook at a monastery, and a very austere monastery where they just had like, they just ate water with some grains of rice in it and stuff. So, and because the abbot was very strict. And so one day the abbot was out of town. Yeah, and so this, the Tenzo said, I know I'm not supposed to do this, but in the kitchen cabinet, there's these, you know, great homemade noodles. And they've just been waiting there for the past like 25 years. because the abbot won't let us eat anything but water with rice, grains. But he's gone, and I might get in trouble for this. But I really, my job as Tenzo is to nourish the Sangha. I'm going to cook those noodles. So he did. The abbot came back. Where are those noodles? And he didn't try to evade it at all or make any excuses. I cooked them and fed the monks. And so Nahla was like, so you'll be leaving now, right? You can't stay here. You broke the guidelines. Very strict, right? And I think actually the way that I've heard the story told is that the abbot comes up and like, did you take those noodles and eat them with the community? And he said, yes, I did. Please punish me now. That's even more like open and vulnerable response, right? Please punish me now. And he's like, okay, well, I guess we got to do that. This is we got to enact. This is how it works in cause and effect. So he loved the student very much, right? But it's like, you have to go now. We can't just let people break the guidelines and nothing happen. So he left. But he was a very sincere practitioner. He stayed true to his practice and he didn't deprecate himself and say like, maybe I'm not cut out to be a Zen practitioner. I really blew it. He's like, I just really want to practice and that's my teacher too. So he hung out just, you know, outside the monastery gate and there was a little like garage shed out there that was, you know, owned by the monastery, but it was not much stuff in there. He just kind of camped out in there to be nearby, just feel the presence of his teacher nearby, and practiced there for a while. And at some point, the teacher got word that he was staying in the shed, and he's like, have you been staying in a monastery property? And he's like, yes, I have. Maybe if he said, please punish me now, again. He said, okay, this is the amount of rent you owe for the past year of staying there. You can, please pay it back as soon as you can. So strict. But again, this practitioner was just so true to himself, didn't deprecate himself or make excuses. I think the greatest thing about this story is he didn't defend himself slightly. Okay, I'll pay the rent. You know, he wasn't expecting that. He's like, really? After all this? Give me a break the second time. Okay, I'll pay the rent. And so he just went begging for like the next year or something to gather enough funds to pay the rent, and finally paid it back. And eventually the teacher said, okay, you can come back now. And then he went on to be a great Zen ancestor. So maybe getting kicked out, it's okay.
I would have hoped that the abbot would have said, oh, there's a tenzo position open here.
Yeah, there's a tenzo position and there's actually nothing left in the cabinets. So do whatever you want. Yeah, but I think that's a story about vulnerability, actually, about coming from bodhicitta. It was never for himself, right? It was just like, I just want to feed the community and make this gift, and I might get in trouble for it, and it's okay, and it's totally, I totally acknowledge it. I'm not going to hide my faults or put forward my virtues. I'm just this person, and that's enough. Yes.
It puts
Very difficult. I know from experience this is very difficult. As I say, like my tendencies are not to be so strict with others, but being Tanto, the Tan head at Tassajara, the responsibility came to me to give the word when people have to leave. Very difficult. People who, my Dharma companions and friends, I did have to do it once, I remember, maybe twice. And that's kind of the thing. So, you know, and that it was a very, actually, great practice opportunity to say, kind of like, that's how I understand that story. That teacher who loved the student said, I have the, my sense of it is it's kind of like, I love you, and cause and effect works like this. We have to enact this thing now. It's like with love and compassion, and it's not even just a matter of you and me. This is like, it's a whole Sangha event. So the you know, and of course I didn't have to make the decision. I just had to enact it. I was part of the decision, but and then because, you know, what happens, this is, it's tricky, right? Because if you don't, then the next person does the same thing and says, nothing happened to that person. And then the whole thing just falls apart. The whole structure, the beautiful, you know, lattice work of a monastery that those vines can grow on just kind of collapses. Maybe that's kind of extreme, but to some extent, I think that happens. Yeah, difficult. But again, coming from this place of just honesty, not like let's pretend that like we're just the enforcer now. It's more like I feel so. I think maybe it's even like, well, how do you feel about it? Maybe that's one way I think it might have gone. Being the person who has to say something, well, this happened, and actually I think they were given like a second and third chance and a lot of leeway, but finally it's like, well, what do you think should happen now? Really, honestly, like, because this was a sincere practitioner too, right? So so I think they might be said, yeah, I could see how now it's reasonable that I go. It was a little bit like, please punish me now. This person was a little like that. Kind of like, I really, it's so sad to leave Tassajara, it's been my home, but I understand completely. So that's a great spirit of practice too. It's like, don't make me leave, I'll do anything. May all beings just vulnerably open to who they are right now, not better, worse, or equal, and just receive the colors and sounds of the moment like a little baby. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. The illusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.